Very good. So what I was saying then is we'll start with the motivation for this first lecture. We want to talk about tensor networks. And the motivation is that we want to be able to talk efficiently or efficiently represent with functions of n spin system and spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. And so what we know is for sure that this wave function or this state, quantum state, can be expanded in a basis of product states for the spins by just specifying a number of complex coefficients. So these indices I1, I2, IN, all run from, they can take values up or down, or for simplicity, 0 or 1. And then, for instance, if this was the case of n equal to 3 spins, what this means is that we can always expand this wave function in terms of the following states. So linear combination. And all the way to psi 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay. So this took, in this case, well, in the generic case, we will be using 2 to the n complex coefficients. Okay? And as you know, this is a problem computationally, because if you try to put n spins for n equal to, if you try to represent this wave function using 2 to the n coefficients, if n is 20, maybe your laptop is not going to complain. If n is 40, there is no computer on Earth that can do that. Okay? So this exponential growth of the coefficient required to describe a wave function of n spins, that is computationally a very serious issue. And what we would like to do here is to be able to study ground states. We would like to be able to study ground states of such systems, ground states of local Hamiltonians for, say, n spins. And well, we need to do something about it. Okay, so this lecture is about the strategy to deal with wave functions of representing ground states of local Hamiltonians for, say, n spins for large n. And we actually think that this should be possible, or it's not. It's clear that if we try to represent an arbitrary wave function of n spins, this takes exponentially many coefficients. But there is another observation that is relevant here, which is that if we consider a local Hamiltonian, H as made of sum of local terms IHI, where PHI means something like maybe you have sides or spins in your lattice, and this is spin I, so this is some HI. HI lives around, it's local and centered on spin I. Okay, so this is not a term that is only acting on one spin. It may be acting on a finite neighborhood of that spin. But the idea is if you look at local Hamiltonians, then what you realize is that you have n such terms. And so therefore, you can specify the local Hamiltonian with order n parameters, where n is the number of spins or sides in your lattice. And so if you see that, well, each ground state of a local Hamiltonian corresponds to a local Hamiltonian. You can specify this local Hamiltonian with order n parameters. So that means you can specify the ground state in principle with order n parameters, for instance, by just giving the Hamiltonian. Okay? So what I'm saying is we have this huge, huge mess here. We have this Hilbert space, which is huge. It's parametrized by exponentially many parameters. But if we care about ground states of local Hamiltonians, and that's what we usually care in physics, then it turns out that we can specify this ground state by just specifying a Hamiltonian, which only takes order n, not exponentially n, but just order n parameters. Okay? So order n parameters is no problem, because you can go to very large systems if the cost, the computational cost, or the memory that is required to store this information only grows linearly in n. Okay? So what this is telling us is that there is hope that we might be able to represent and manipulate the ground states of local Hamiltonians by using much less than exponentially many coefficients. Okay? So our goal is precisely this, is to find an efficient representation, and then I will also add computational scheme, an efficient computational scheme, okay, for ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay? Maybe that's very ambitious, but there is a hint that it might be possible, because just specifying this ground state truth, the Hamiltonian is already possible efficient. Okay? And so by computational scheme, I mean, I don't want to just say, this is the ground state of certain Hamiltonian. I want to be able to extract its properties. I want to be able to compute two-point correlators, entanglement entropies, all type of physical quantities. Very good. And why am I talking about this in this summer school? Well, we have a very important hint towards this goal, which is given by the scaling of entanglement in many body ground states. And so the goal was this, and the hint that we're going to be using relates directly with the first lecture from yesterday by Orazio Cassini, where we just have to look at the scaling of entanglement entropy. Entanglement entropy. And what exactly do we want to see there? Or what's the important aspect? Well, remember, what we're going to do for simplicity is I'm going to stick to one-dimensional systems. In one dimension, we'll consider a region A within the one-dimensional system. The rest is going to be called B. We'll look at if we take the ground state of a local Hamiltonian there. And remember, we will trace out part B, and this will produce some density matrix A. Okay? So what we learned yesterday is that if we look at the entropy S of L defined as the entropy of this reduced density matrix, I'm going to assume that A contains L sites. Okay? So I have possibly an infinite chain, and I trace in the ground state, and I trace out all the sites except for a block A of size L. So if I look at the entropy of the reduced density matrix, what we learned yesterday, this was given by rho A trace rho A, log rho A. What we learned yesterday is that already from quantum field theory is that this entropy behaves in a very peculiar way. So let me plot here as a function of the system size of the region L. So this is L. I'm going to plot the entropy. And what we have, I'm going to draw three lines. The first one corresponds to the entropy being proportional to the size of the interval. And that would be what we have in a thermal state, for instance. Now I'm going to also draw another line, which is the entropy being proportional to the logarithm of L only. And then finally a third line, where the entropy saturates to a constant. Okay? And what we've learned over the last 10 years or so, or more, is that ground states, so this thing here, this linear growth, that's what you would have for a generic space in the, for a generic state, for a generic wave function of n spins. Okay? So this is a generic state. Whereas for ground state, we have two situations. Ground state of local Hamiltonian, we have two situations. A logarithmic growth, if this is for the gapless they correspond to gapless H, so a Hamiltonian at a critical quantum critical point, or for a gap Hamiltonian. Okay, so here there is the gap in the energy spectrum is zero. Here the gap in the energy spectrum is Laurent. So there is this. If we have ground states of local Hamiltonians, what we see is in one dimension is that the amount of entanglement entropy, the amount of entropy in these ground states is much, much smaller than what it could be. It's L versus log L or a constant. Okay? So that's the big hint. That's the hint that we will use to develop a formalism to efficiently represent wave functions of corresponding to ground states. Okay? It might be also true for low energy excited states. Yes. Here I'll focus for simplicity on ground state. Very good. So I insist that the conclusion is ground states are weakly entangled. And this is the main one of the main lessons we've learned in the last few years, and that will be the basis for being able to efficiently represent the wave function of a ground state. Very good. So now it's a good time. I would ask if we can have the first slide. Excellent. Thank you. So tensor networks. How are we going to efficiently represent these wave functions for ground states? How are we going to have an efficient description of ground states? Well, it's going to look like something like these drawings, okay? The first drawing has a name, matrix product state. The second, down there, is the multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. Or the third one, projected entangled pair states. Lots of names. We'll be using the acronyms most of the time, MPS, MetaPEPS. So I would like to spend 5 minutes to try to give you an idea of what all these drawings mean. And that's going to be important for the rest of the lectures. So maybe we can leave that on. But I'm going to introduce some graphical notation. So, and that's what we use all the time.
I think that's a better idea to take that one. Because that people in the back are not able to see that.
Good point. Can we switch this off, please? Excellent, thanks. Graphical notation. OK, so I'm going to use the following. Every time you see a circle, okay, with no legs, that's going to correspond to a complex number. Okay, so this is some complex number z. If you see instead a circle with one leg, that corresponds to some vector with an index alpha. So this leg is used to denote an index alpha. Similarly, if you see a circle with two legs, then that will be a matrix. And so on, right? So in general, if you see a circle with some number of legs, with n legs, then that would correspond to some tensor, which could, for instance, be this tensor that we use to parameterize the exponentially many or that contains the exponentially many coefficients of a wave function. Okay? So if you see a circle with legs, from now on that's a tensor with n indices. Question?
Is there any convention for the direction the legs go?
We will not need to worry about that. But indeed, you could ask, is that a matrix or is it a bipartite state or something? Yeah, it's what it is. It's tensor with two indices, right? And that's all we need to know. Okay? Very good. So that's the notation that we'll be using. I need to introduce another bit. So that's individual elements, what they mean. And now what I need to do as well, I'll do it up here, is I will also tell you what it means to find in those drawings you'll often find that there are tensors which are connected. They share, so there are circles that share a line. So what this is actually, this is equal to that. When you see this part you already know what it is. This is, we said this was a matrix, okay? And this here is a matrix and this is a matrix. So what is this? Summer school, interaction, no. So what is this? Sorry? Right, it's the product of two matrices, okay? So whenever you see an index that is shared by two tensors, what we are saying here is that we have a matrix A alpha beta, which is equal to the sum over an intermediate index gamma of B alpha gamma and C gamma beta, okay? So this would be gamma, there is a sum. If you see a leg shared by two circles, that's this is an index contraction. You have to sum over that index. Very good, so let's have a couple of examples, and I'll be asking you what these things are. So what is, say, this thing? Somebody? It's a matrix times a vector. It's becoming so simple that it seems insulting now. Very good. So what if I give you this one? Sorry? Of four matrices? Is that what? Sorry, I couldn't see who was talking. Very good. So the first thing, that's indeed the trace of four matrices, okay? Hope this is clear. So the first thing you have to do when you see a drawing like this, say a drawing like that, you have to think, how many open legs do I have, right? Because this, the indices connecting the circles are, there is a sum over them, so this has to be equal to some single tensor with as many legs as open legs you have on this side, okay? So if I show you this, this is a collection of small tensors that if I multiply the indices according to the pattern described by this network, will give me another tensor with four indices. So I could use this to represent the complex coefficients of a wave function of on four spins, for instance. Okay? Very good. So let me give you an example. Yes. Suppose that we have a wave function. So this is now psi i1, i2, in. These are the complex coefficients. These are the complex coefficients that describe this wave function on n spins. So imagine that we are interested in the case where this wave function is actually a product state. Remember from Horacio's lecture yesterday, that the product state is one where each spin has its own state. There are no correlations, there is no entanglement. So in this case, what we have is some wave function for the first spin, and a wave function for the second spin, and so on. Okay? So that would correspond to not having entanglement at all. And in our notation, this would correspond, this will be represented by individual vector. Remember, this was a vector, we said it before. So what we'll have is a vector for the first spin, a vector for the second spin, and so on. Okay? So why am I drawing this as an example? Well, I want you to look at this and think, okay, that's also a tensor network. It's a weird one where individual tensors are not connected. So that's the way you want to think about the bond indices connecting the different tensors. If we don't have connections between tensors, we're describing a wave function with no entanglement. Therefore, if I now come here and say, no, actually, I'm not interested in this case, so suppose my wave function is not a product, instead, I'm going to draw indices connecting the different tensors, what I'm doing is I'm now preparing a tensor network that describes an entangled state, okay? No indices connecting tensors implies no entanglement. If you see indices connecting tensors, that allows you to describe entanglement between the different spins. Okay? Very good. So now maybe we're ready to go back to the... Are there questions about this? Good, so we can go back to the slide. Can we have that slide back, please? So now you can have a look at this. And what we see here in the first example is a collection of tensors connected in a one-dimensional geometry. So these bone indices connecting different tensors are trying to capture a pattern of entanglement that is the one that we find in ground states of one-dimensional systems. So if you see that, what I'm saying is that the network of tensors, the way the tensors are connected, is trying to emulate the way entanglement appears in the wave function. So if you see a one-dimensional pattern in here, this wave function, this tensor network, is ready to represent ground states where there is mostly entanglement between nearest neighbors in a one-dimensional geometry. Okay? So if I said that, then can you tell me what this should be doing? What is the expectation of this tensor network? So I said this one would be for one-dimensional systems. That's right. So this PEPS is an ansatz, is a tensor network that is used to represent ground states of two-dimensional systems. Okay? And this one is a mess, and we will talk about it tomorrow. Very good. So then, just to give you some context about, I mean, at this point, if you see this, you know what a tensor network is, right? It's a collection of tensors which are connected according to some network pattern. And what they do is they describe some wave function, okay? And this wave function will have a structure of entanglement which is related to the way you've been connecting the tensors together. Very good. So we've seen this. And so what I want to tell you, just to give you a bit of context, is that tensor networks, the study of tensor networks started seriously maybe 10 years ago or so. It's the work of many, many people. I only wrote a few names here. There are many, many people who work on that. And it started as a computational tool for condensed matter systems. So we were trying to really describe efficiently ground states. This would be a variational ansatz. These tensor networks were thought of as a variational ansatz, as the basis for computational algorithms. But it turns out that over time it has evolved a little bit, and for instance, there have been in the last 3-4 years a lot of work in classifying gap phases of quantum matter. This is analytical work, but it uses the fact that tensor networks can represent ground states efficiently as, again, the basis, okay? So the idea is you say ground states can be represented at least in one dimension with these tensor networks, then let's study possible ways in which we can write these tensor networks. Let's see. So we have a natural framework to have a theoretical discussion on ground states. And that's what was used to obtain a classification of gap phases in one-dimensional systems and extensions to two dimensions and so on. So it started as a computational tool, and it's now currently being used for theoretical, as a theoretical framework. Also, it extended to material science. There are different initiatives. Even Simons Foundation is funding some collaboration to bring tensor networks all the way to the level of material science. Tensor networks are currently used also in quantum chemistry, in classical statistical mechanics. Tensor networks have been used to rederive this renormalization group, or to implement in a modern way ideas from Wilson's renormalization group, and this will be very clear in the second and third lectures. And also, it's currently under intense investigation and in the context of holography. So what I mean by this is that if you learn a couple of things in these lectures, you may be able to use this knowledge later on for a number of in a number of directions. Very good. So can we have this off, please? That one? Yes. Okay. Sure. So what are we going to see in these lectures? Looks fine, no? So we'll have three lectures in the first and today. Today, I'll continue with this introduction to tensor networks, and we will also discuss matrix product states, which were the simplest one-dimensional tensor network. Tomorrow, I will tell you about MIRA, the second tensor network we had on the blackboard, and on Thursday, I will tell you about this modern formulation of the RG flow in terms of tensor networks. And these lectures relate closely to, or some of these lectures relate closely to the lectures by Wilke. In particular, he will bring us, so my lectures will be mostly describing the theoretical foundations of tensor networks. And Wilke will take it, will take MIRA, and will bring it closer to, he will have a more computational discussion, also in terms of Mathematica, and then apart from that, we will have the problems session where you will go all the way down to implementing some of these ideas yourself, okay? Very good, so let's continue. I'm done with the motivation. And now I want to start with a simple tensor network. I want to describe the simplest possible. So there are many tensor networks in the market. And you may wonder, well, why should I use one or the other? What can different tensor networks do for me? And so what I want to start with is a discussion of a pretty useless tensor network. And I want us to understand why it's useless. Okay. So 1b is a simple equal to useless tensor network. Good. So the tensor network I proposed that we discussed for a while is the following. It's based on a quantum circuit. So the idea is, I have quantum gates. Wrong. All right. Oh, actually, I have it in the computer. Yeah. Can I have the slide, please, Ron? So I'm going to assume the following. I'm going to assume that the wave function of n spins can be obtained, can be parametrized as a result of starting from a product state of n spins and applying two body gates consecutively to the spins. Okay, so rows, one row of two body gates, second row, and so on. I'm going to do this a number of times, and I start from a product state, but these gates introduce entanglement, so the resulting wave function down here is entangled. And I'm going to use this as a first example of a tensor network. And what's interesting about this is that if we put a number t of rows, which is, say, equal to n, so we have n spins, and suppose we put n rows of gates, then each gate takes some number of parameters, on the order of 8 or some number. So the total number of parameters, we have n times n gates, so n square gates. So The representation of this wave function took only order n square parameter. Okay? The growth in n, in the number of spins, is only n square. So we have an efficient representation. Okay? Is that clear? So what I'm saying then is that we have the ability to represent efficiently through this quantum circuit. We have the ability to efficiently represent a wave function, but this is the same as saying, well, yes, ground states can be specified efficiently by giving the Hamiltonian. Okay, so There are a series of questions we have to ask about the tensor network to understand whether the tensor network is useful or not. And whether we have an efficient representation of the wave function is only the first question. So questions that we want to ask to determine whether a tensor network is going to be useful, there are two types of questions. First, computational questions. And then questions about what type of state we're representing, physics. This is physics. Okay? So computational questions, we just answer one, is there an efficient representation? Right? It's a necessary condition for this to be useful. Can we efficiently specify the state? But it's not sufficient for it to be useful. We also need the ability to perform efficient computations with it. And that's where this guy is going to give us trouble. Okay? So being able to efficiently specify a wave function is not the same as being able to efficiently extract information from it. So now I want to discuss in which sense this wave function from this tensor network, we won't be able to efficiently extract information. So if we just want, let's look at the efficient computation. Let's first consider the computation of psi. Let's try to see what the norm of this state is. That is necessary in order to compute any expectation value, so let's start with this one. I guess I'm going to be a bit in trouble switching back and forth, but I need this. Can I have the slide again? Thanks. So this is the wave function, okay? And now what we can ask is how much is the norm? And the norm is obtained by taking the Brand-Deket. So just take the Brand-Deket on the quantum circuit. But remember, these are unitary transformations. So what we will have is that if this is unitary transformation U, this is U daga. Okay? So U daga amount to the identity when you multiply them together, right? These are unitary transformations. So this will cancel with this one, this will with this one, this with this one. So we'll be done with the first rows, central rows of tensors. And then this is going to be some other unitary V, and this is V dagger. And they will also cancel because these guys are gone, so this V and V dagger are multiplied together. And so what you can see is that just because of the nature of these ansatz, which is a quantum circuit, this is a big unitary transformation, this is its conjugate, so when you compute the norm, this disappears, and you end up with a scalar with the norm of the initial state you started from, which is a product state, with norm equal to 1. So there is no problem at all in computing the norm of this variational ansatz. It's always 1. Okay? We don't even need to compute it. We know it's 1. Very good? So this is not a problem. The problem comes when we try the next thing. And the next thing is to compute the expectation value of a local observable. And for the sake of minimizing switching on and off, let me first tell you how the calculation looks like. So this is the wave function, psi. This is a local observable. This is sigma z, the magnetization or something. Sigma z on site 5 or 10 or whatever, right? So psi, sigma z, and psi, bra and ket. Very good. So now you see, we would like to compute this expectation value. And what we know, again, is that there will be many simplifications in this tensor network, because this is some unitary transformation, and this is its daga, so U daga, annihilate. All these lots of unitary transformations will, lots of two spin gauge will annihilate again. Okay? But not all of them. For instance, this one cannot annihilate with this one because there is some fraction in the middle, precisely the operator we're trying to, for which we're trying to get the expectation value. And so after these manipulations, what we see is that we are left with some tensor network, which is some part of the original tensor network. And now there are no more cancellations. Now we have to take this object and actually compute how much You see, this is a number, there are no open legs. This is the expectation value we want, but we don't know how much it is. So we would need to crunch these matrices together. Okay, so the claim is that this is hard. This is exponentially hard, and I want to justify this claim. And again, this is going to be what I'm describing now is going to be useful also for the examples that we care about. This is a useless tensor network. We will see why it's useless, but we'll learn how to look for useful tensor networks in the process. Very good. So what do we need to know? First, we need to understand what's the cost, computational cost, of multiplying two matrices together. Okay? So what we have here is some matrix A, C, this is A, this is B, and now this is index alpha, beta, alpha, this is gamma, sorry, alpha, beta, and gamma. So what we're saying, this is the tensor network notation for C, alpha, gamma, equal to sum over beta of A, alpha, beta, B, beta, gamma. Very good. So, and now I'm going to assume, so how do we do this calculation, right? What we're going to do is the following. For each, so alpha goes from 1 to some number that I'm going to denote as the size of alpha. Okay? This is the number of values that index alpha takes. And the same for gamma. Gamma goes from 1 all the way to gamma values. So what we're saying is that we have to perform this. We have to multiply A alpha beta times B beta gamma for each value of alpha and gamma. So we have to do this basic sum operation, alpha, size of alpha times size of gamma times. And what is this operation? Well, we have to sum over the values of beta. So that's the size of beta, right? What I'm saying is we have to perform a number of simple operations that scales as the size, as the product of the size of the three indices. Okay? This is something that you may already know well, but I wanted to quickly review so that we can go to the next level, which is the following. Well, is it clear that the cost of multiplying two matrices is the product of the sizes of the three indices involved? Okay? If it's clear, great. If it's not clear, let's just remember it. Let's keep the result. And now I want to ask you a question. Suppose I have a tensor here and another tensor here, and I have some brutal number of indices multiplying the tensors. Okay? I want to multiply these two tensors. So I'm building up the basic thing that I need to answer the question how hard it is to compute that expectation value. And so if you look at this, you have some tensor here. I'm going to call it again A. This one, I'm going to call it B. And I'm going to assume that the size of all the indices is the same. It's chi. So each index goes from 1 to chi. Okay? So the question I'm asking, and maybe just to make it nicer, we'll put this. So here we have 1, 2, 3, 4 indices. Here we have 3 indices. And here we have 5 indices. And the question is, what's the computational cost as a function of the size of these indices, as a function of chi, of performing this tensor multiplication? So I want an answer of the form. The cost scales as some power of chi. And what I'm asking is, what's p? What's this power? Sorry? I keep not seeing who's talking, but that's fine. What did you say? 4 times 3 times 5? Okay. That's 12? I'm confused. Why is it 12? Okay, so the size of the first index is chi to the 4, right? Of this index, I mean, you can regard this as a matrix multiplication, right? This is nothing but having matrix A with an index here which is thick, and it's chi to the 4, sorry. And another index, thick index in the middle, which is chi to the 3, and a final and then these other metrics, and I find we're just putting all these indices together into a single one, so that's chi to the 5. And so the cost of this is going to be chi to the 4 times chi to the 3 times chi to the 5. That's I don't know why I put these things here. The cost is multiplying the sizes of all the indices. So that's indeed p is going to be equal to 4 plus 3 plus 5, which is 12. Okay? So if what I'm saying is if you have to multiply tensors together, there is a cost attached to it, you can quickly evaluate, assuming that all the indices have the same size, you can quickly evaluate this cost. Okay? Just multiply the sizes of all the indices involved. Very good. So now I want to use this just to check that we understood what's happening here. Let's apply it to two simple examples. First example is I'm going to give you a multiplication, simple multiplication. Okay, we have these matrices. So we're going to have, we have order n of those, and I tell you that each index takes chi values. Okay, so what I would like to know is what's the cost leaving order in n and chi of performing this multiplication. This is a number. There are no open indices, so I would like to get the number. Right? I give you the matrices and vectors involved in here, and the question is how much, what's the computational cost, order n, p, and chi, q, to get this number. Sorry, the person who answers, can you raise their hand? Okay. Chi to the power of n minus 1. What's the strategy? How would you get there? What are you doing? Maybe, but this is very expensive. So if you can break this into matrix multiplications, instead of putting all the tensors together at once, instead of summing, making all the contractions at once, which may have the cost you mentioned, we can break this into pieces. And that's always very important in tensor algorithms, break it into pieces. Okay? And if we break it into pieces, I mean, see, this is exponential in n. We don't like exponentials. Okay? That would be exponentially hard in n. Can somebody find a strategy which would take order n and then some power of chi? Sorry?
N times chi.
N times chi. Good. How would you get there?
For every contract index, there are chi multiplications.
Right.
And there are n of those. We can do every contract one at a time.
So you want to do this one. Mm-hmm. But see, you'll have to do this. This is a vector times a matrix multiplication. So how many tensors, how many indices do you see here? Good. So we can do this, that's the right answer. We can do this is in chi square, cost chi square, that's the cost of one multiplication. Each multiplication involves two tensors and two indices, so chi square. And then we repeat this n times or n minus one times or some number order n times. Okay? So there is a lesson to be learned from this example, which is don't try to deal with the whole tensor network at once. Always break it into pieces and proceed sequentially and try to find the path that will involve smaller tensors, tensor as small as possible at each time. So the second example is to test whether we have learned anything in the first example. So again, we have a number. This is a tensor network representing some complex number. there are no open legs, okay? And I'm going to assume that this is L times L. And the question I'm asking you, and all the bond, all the indices are of size chi, okay, same chi. So the question is, what's the order in L and chi? And if nobody answers, I'll ask Pedro. So please help Pedro. L squared, chi squared. The answer is not correct, but it's useful that you answered. So how would you try to achieve this cost? Okay, so if I take every line as you propose, so if I think you're proposing to take these guys together, then what we'll have is that we'll have some a situation like this, right? So this is not going to be size chi, it's going to be chi to the L. And so what we'll get is the cost is scales as chi to the L to L, right? Because we have in this multiplication, we have two indices with total size chi to the 2L. So again, this is not good. This is exponentially large in L. Okay? So we will not be able to do this for large L. Any other proposal? One by one snake? So you would like to first multiply these two together, and then the third one? Okay, let's think about this one. I think that's the best strategy I can think of, okay? But we'll see that it also has a serious problem. Because after you've multiplied the first two guys, you end up with a tensor with three legs. If you now multiply the next one, you'll get a tensor with an extra leg. And every time you progress in this direction, okay? So the proposal is to proceed sequentially to multiply this times this, then times this, times this, times this, as in a snake. And that's probably one of the optimal ways of doing this, but the cost is not good. In the sense that you see that at this point, when you're done with the first row, you've created a tensor, an intermediate tensor with Lx. Okay? So manipulating this object, the power here is going to be some power order L. And this could be L squared, okay? So this is roughly the optimal strategy we can have. And the message is, we cannot efficiently contract, efficiently as in linear in L, or as a power of L, we cannot efficiently contract a two-dimensional tensor network, okay? There is a very, from a computational perspective, there is a very clear cut between one-dimensional tensor networks, which we can always efficiently compute because we can proceed sequentially without creating big monsters, okay? And two or three dimensional tensor network, or more than one dimension, where if we try to contract the tensors, we'll build some intermediate huge tensor, which will be exponentially, at least in the linear size of the system, okay? So this is why, can we please go back to the slide? This is why this scheme is not good. We ended up with a tensor network which is not one dimensional, it's two dimensional. And contracting that tensor network, you can think of your best, you know, you can propose strategies how we are going to proceed sequentially, maybe from the center, it doesn't matter. There will be some intermediate step where you will have to create a tensor with a number of legs which is proportional to the system size, or in this case to the length, to t, to the number of rows. So if t is proportional to n, there we are, exponential. We have a cost which is exponential in the system size. Okay? Any questions about this?
What happens if the tensor is actually sort of sparse? Does that affect the computational strategy, I mean, the interaction between all the variables?
That's a very good question. So if you have a multiplication of two matrices which are sparse, what's the leading cost? That's right. It depends on the sparsity. So the answer to your question is depends on the answer to the next question, which is depending on what type of sparse tensors do you have in mind, right? If your sparse tensors, when you multiply them together, there's an exponential. If the number of non-zero elements grows still with the number of tensors you put together, you'll have an exponential growth. If these tensors that are sparse have the property that when you put them together, the number of parameters does not grow exponentially, then you would be fine. There are three questions in the line. If you encounter a big tensor at some stage, that's the bottleneck of your computation. If that object is exponentially large, the leading cost is exponential. So that doesn't help. If what you're proposing by mentioning Kadanoff blocking is also some sort of coordinating transformation where you approximate product of two tensors with some new tensor, that's what we will be discussing. Maybe the last day on Thursday. But this is no longer an exact calculation. It's an approximate calculation. And a priori, you cannot guarantee that the final result is good. So I don't want to go there now. Very good. That's a very good question. I mean, observation. It was not a question, right? That's still not the question, right? So what happens is... Okay, that's a very aggressive question now. So the answer is with PEPs you cannot efficiently exactly compute expectation values. You are absolutely right. You cannot exactly compute expectation values. Or the cost of an exact calculation of an expectation value is exponential in the linear size of the system. But then, I think it was Shiva who was suggesting maybe we can coarse grain, maybe we can do approximate tensor network manipulations. And that's where, if the PEPs is representing the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, it turns out that there is an efficient approximate way of extracting information. But this really depends not just on the structure of the tensor network, but actually the state that you are encoding in that tensor network. So you're exploiting that the ground state has short range entanglement, a number of properties that are not encoded in the tensor network itself, right? This tensor network offers you a variational answer. For particular values of the variational parameters, it might be possible to efficiently, approximately extract information. Yes, I think there is some measure. I used to know these things. In practice, we always stick to the same tensor network, so that's not very relevant. But if you want to explore the best contraction scheme, I think it's given by something called the tree width of the graph, which is basically look for where it's thinner and just try to find a sequence. Take the graph and try to replace it in some sense by a tree, by removing all the loops, by putting together tensors, and that will give you some effective dimension. For instance, the new tensor will have a larger number of indices, and then in this case, the answer, for instance, for the two-dimensional case, is the best you can do is actually build this monster. Okay, that's the tree width of this tensor network. Juan, I think you had a question? Okay, so today I was talking about exact manipulation. So I start with the tensor network. In this case, I have not even discussed whether that's a useful tensor network in the sense of representing ground states that we are interested in. I was just saying, let's take this as an example and have this discussion about computational aspects, okay? So we'll get to the physics very soon. Okay, very good. I don't know what time it is. Oh, nice. Not so nice. But what I can do quickly is to tell you what. So, somebody could have said, okay, no problem. Let's fix T, the number of rows in this variational answer, to be 3. Okay, so independent of system size, then there is no exponential growth anymore of the computational cost in the system size, because it doesn't matter how large the system is, we'll go from the first diagram, you know, the system size will determine how much we extend in both directions, but if we want to compute this expectation value, it will be, in regardless of how many sites we have in both directions, the only thing that matters when it comes to computing this expectation value is how many rows of gates we started from. So if we fix this to, say, 3 or 4 in this case, then for any system size, the cost of computing an expectation value is the cost of evaluating this, which is order, I mean, it's independent of n, okay? So what I'm saying is we can further restrict these ansatz to just, instead of being n times n quantum circuit, it's now going to be n, the system size that we're interested in, the size of your spin chain, times 4, okay? Then we have an efficient scheme. But let me tell you what happens with the physics. Let's look at the physics of, or the type of wave function that these ansatz can represent. So what I'm going to do, specifically, I'm going to evaluate a two-point operator, okay? I'm going to assume that we have a quantum circuit made of 4 rows only, for a system that could be infinite, or very large. And now I'm trying to put the expectation value of a two-point correlator. And what I see is the following. What I see is that, well, there are all these cancellations, okay? So I end up having to contract this tensor network, and now I'm happy because this is just the product of this times that. So this cost is independent of the system size. Remember, it's just, for any system size, I'll get the same product. This is a tensor network. The cost is independent of n, the cost is independent of n here, so I have the product of 2 tensor networks. So great, I can efficiently compute the two-point correlator as well. Now the question is, what am I learning from here? Well, this is exactly the calculation I would have if I only wanted this one-point correlator, right? So what I'm learning is that, let me see if I drew this, no I didn't. What I'm learning is that the two-point correlator psi, some operator O on some position 0, some operator O on some position L, when L is larger than 4, that this breaks, this is equal to psi of O0 represented by the first tensor network times psi of OL represented by the second tensor network down there. So what this means is, if I put a minus sign, this is the connected correlator, it's equal to 0. So there we are. What we see is that if we want to turn this quantum circuit into an efficient tensor network from which we can extract information, by limiting the number of rows in the tensor network, automatically we get that we're representing wave functions that are the half correlations at short distances, but after order t distances, they are the wave function has no correlation to that. Okay? All the connected correlators are identically 0 after some distance. So that doesn't sound very physical. Maybe you can use that as a means to represent a ground state of a very shortly correlated system. But then again, if you try to then get closer to a critical point where the correlation length grows, you will have to increase exponentially. The cost, it will mean we'll have to deal with larger tensor networks to compute expectation values. And so there we are again. We have an exponential cost in the correlation length in the system. Okay, very good. So what I'm going to do next is actually start to talk about matrix product states. And we have 15, is that correct? We have 10, 15 minutes? 12 minutes? Okay, so I'll start and I'll continue tomorrow. So far we've been dealing with this useless tensor network, and now I would like to tell you about matrix product states, which are a very useful tensor network. So, 1C, matrix product states. And as you've seen in some plots before, this is the case where we connect all the tensors in one dimension. And then we can quickly, remember we have a list of questions we have to ask about the tensor network. The first two are computational. So question number one, do we have an efficient representation? And the answer is very simple. We look at a single tensor. We assume that the indices take only chi values. So this is chi, and this is some index that run, say, up and down in our case. So this is the size of I of this index is 2, up, down, 0, 1. And so the number of parameters in a single tensor is chi times d. And now what we see is that we have n of those, right? For each side in our system, we have one tensor. And so the total number of parameters goes as n chi squared d. Okay? So if we assume that chi is not a function of n, then we have an efficient representation where, in order to represent the wave function of n spins, we need a number of parameters which is only linear in n. Okay? So everybody should be very, very happy. Now the question we've seen before is, the important question is not whether this is an efficient representation, but also can we efficiently extract information from it? And I'm going to be able to answer this second question very quickly because we've seen all the elements that we needed already. So the first question, efficient representation, the answer is yes. And now we want to ask, can we efficiently compute the scalar product or the norm of this state, the expectation value of a local observable, and so on? So question number two, efficient calculation, computation. And for instance, the first question is how much is psi psi, right? So if this was representing our wave function, then this will boil down to writing the ket and then the bra. And assuming that all these indices take chi values, and these take two values, I'm going to ask you the question, what's the leading, so we have n sides, what's the leading cost in n and chi, so p and q, for this calculation? Can you raise your hand? N, chi to the 4. That sounds like a very good answer. How do you do that? So you contract this into this. So first you multiply these guys vertically. Yeah. And so you end up with this problem that we have analyzed already, but where these indices are double. And so that gives you chi 4. OK, so that's the right leading order in n. And it turns out this is a very good answer, but it can be improved in the following. If instead of multiplying this times this vertically first, you defer, you don't do that yet, there is an even better strategy, which is the one that is used, where what you're going to do is you're going to proceed. I'm just going to draw it and then discuss it. So first, we'll multiply these two together, as you proposed. But then instead of multiplying these two together, first, we'll
add this one,
and then the other one. So in a sense, we'll be snaking around. We'll be multiplying in this way,
as opposed to first vertically and then horizontally. And the benefit of that is
very clear, because it will only involve, and maybe we don't need to discuss this in detail right now,
but it gives you a chi to the 3. We managed to lower that, okay? But yes, this is the answer. We can efficiently compute the norm of our wave function with a cost which is linear in n
and some power, third power of the one dimension.
Very good. So
Excellent. But computing the norm is not the most exciting thing you want to do with a wave function. You also want to compute the expectation values of, say, sigma z on site 12, right? Or maybe 12 is a bad number given the small, so say site 3. And so what you would have to do in this case is you go to the same drawing. So I'm going to insert here some sigma z on site 3. That's some tensor that I have to put in here, okay? But this is essentially the same calculation as before after I multiply these two together. So it's not going to change the cost. I can also compute expectation values of local observables, single site observables, with the same cost. And actually what I said also applies if you, I want a two-point correlator or an n-point correlator. Provided that all these operators are just acting on one side, what we have is that we can evaluate n-point correlators with the same leading cost, n chi to the 3, okay? So this gives a very clear answer, positive answer, to the question whether we can efficiently extract information from these variational angles. Very good. And now we have 5 minutes. And so what I'll do is I'll discuss this type of questions. These two first questions refer to, can we efficiently manipulate this object, okay? But that doesn't mean that this object is approximating ground states of interest. It just means we can efficiently manipulate it. Maybe it's completely useless again. So what I want to argue in 5 minutes is that matrix product states are actually very interesting because they match the properties of ground states of one-dimensional Hamiltonians gap with a gap, with a finite gap. So I will argue this very quickly, and tomorrow I will go through that again. So what do I want to argue? I want to talk about properties of this MPS, this variational class of states, which follow simply from the variational, the structure of the ansatz. So I don't even notice that I'm not optimizing the variational parameters. I'm just going to talk about how the tensor network conditions the wave function in terms of structural properties that are part of this variational class. So, structural properties. And specifically, I want to look at correlations, and I want to look at entanglement entropy. Okay? And what do we want to say about correlations? So let's do what we just said. Let's compute a two-point correlator. So schematically now I'm drawing, you should draw all the tensors here, but I don't want to spend time on that. And now I'm going to insert, I just discovered it had colors here. I'm going to insert an operator here and another operator there. And so this is my two-point correlator. Maybe I have to divide by the norm. I'm going to assume that the wave function has been normalized. So you see, this thing here is equal to wave function, maybe sigma z on site 0. I'm going to call this site 0. I'm going to call this site L. So some other operator, maybe the same one on site L, right? And I'm going to call this my two-point correlator. CL, okay? Oops. Which in principle depends on the distance between the two points. And so what I want to do is to argue that the tensor network itself already tells you how this two-point correlator behaves at long distances, okay? And how does this work? Well, let me first ask you another simpler question, which is, if I have some matrix T, multiplied many, many times, say L times, and then some vector to the left and some vector to the right. So this is equal to B left, some matrix to the Lth power B right, right? And this type, and what I'm asking you is how does this scale for large L, okay? So if you have a vector, you multiply it L times by a matrix and then get a number by multiplying by another vector. What we know is that the answer is, well, look at the eigenvalues of P, right? Look at the largest eigenvalue that is picked up in here. So let lambda be largest eigenvalue. T, then this is going to scale as lambda to the nth power with some coefficient in front. Okay, so what we know is that if we have a sequence of matrices which are the same, and then we compute an expectation value there, that that's going to be lambda, the largest eigenvalue of T that is picked up in this calculation, to the nth power, which is the same as saying exponential of L with some correlation length, and this correlation length, that's not even important, is 1 divided by 1 minus, I got it somewhere here, log of lambda of this eigenvalue. Okay? So what I'm saying is, if you see a structure like this, and they ask you how does this scale with L, the answer is exponentially. Okay? There is an exponential decay with L. Alright? Very good, so that's the answer to this question, right? You can see in here, you can quickly identify that we have exactly this type of structure. We have, remember, this is the expectation value of the two-point correlator. We have some vector here, a left, this is going to be our vector left. We have a vector to the right. And then we have some structure here, which we can call transfer matrix T, which is, sorry, I should have said that. Assume that your MPS has all the tensors to be are the same, okay? All the tensors. So I'm saying in our MPS, I should have said that from the beginning. We're going to study properties in the case where the MPS is made of copies of the same tensor A, okay? So in that case, we have this transfer matrix. Let me draw it here. It's given by A and A star. And this two-point correlator calculation is exactly of the form we just discussed, okay? You have some left vector, some right vector, and a transfer matrix in between, which appears L to the minus 1 times. So this two-point correlator is describing an exponential, at least at long distances. All right, so I must be running out of time. So the only thing I'll add to this is that if, and I'll discuss this tomorrow, is that if we look at the entanglement entropy that these answers can carry, it turns out to saturate to a constant. So remember that we can ask the question how the entropy of an interval of size L scales with the size L, and it turns out that in an MPS, as a function of size L, this saturates, so in the MPS, the entropy saturates to a constant. And this has to do with the fact, well, I'll discuss this tomorrow. So what the conclusion is the following. We have this tensor network, this matrix product state, or MPS, where we've seen that we can efficiently specify the wave function. We can also efficiently extract information from the wave function, so we're happy computationally. And in addition, we've seen that I've argued that the two-point correlators, at least asymptotically, they decay exponentially with distance. And I've announced, and we'll have a look at this tomorrow, that the entropy of a region saturates to a constant. It turns out that these two properties that I just said, exponential decay of correlations and saturation of the entropy, this is exactly what you see in ground states of one-dimensional systems for Hamiltonians which are a gap, okay? Local Hamiltonians with a gap. If there is a gap, we have both this exponential decay of correlations and the saturation of the entropy. And so this makes you think, or should make you think, that maybe this ansatz is a good ansatz to represent ground states of one-dimensional local Hamiltonians with a gap. And, you know, it suggests, right, this property suggests that it might be a good ansatz. It doesn't follow that it's a good ansatz from what I described, but it suggests that it might be a good ansatz. And then you go numerically, and you realize it's an excellent ansatz. We can actually efficiently represent ground states of one-dimensional systems with an MPS. There is no natural Hamiltonian that you could build for which you would not be able to efficiently represent the ground state with an MPS in one dimension. Okay? Okay, thank you. At least at long distances between the three points, it's going to be a similar thing. So you'll have to look at what eigenvectors of this transfer metric have been picked by the operator that you insert. But if you're thinking about universal information,
or suppose I normalize the cosine function to be exponential with unit coefficient.
Right. That will depend on the operators that you are looking at.
Right. Then I want to ask about three-point function.
This is not a CFT, Pedro.
No, I understand.
Okay.
Well, that's what I want to understand. Is what whether here I get a multi generic massive theory or a massive theory which is still characterized by a particular
set. I see. Right. I don't know how to characterize the more general massive theory. So I don't know how to answer your question. But the suspicion is that this NPS, we don't have a counterexample of a ground state that we have not been able to efficient. Ground state of one-dimensional gap system for natural Hamiltonians, you can build counterexamples, but they have nothing to do with physics. I mean, with what would be natural Hamiltonian. Absolutely. That's how you could do that. You can diagonalize this transfer metric and identify all masses in your theory. It's not clear. I've decided not to discuss this, but if you ask this question, the answer is the following. The largest eigenvalue is always 1 by normalization. That's what normalizes your wave function. If not, this eigenvalue would show up also in the computation of the norm, and the norm would be infinite. So you fix the largest eigenvalue to 1, and then by definition, the rest are smaller. So you have exponential decay.